Okay, well, welcome everyone to the Lowy Institute. Let me in particular welcome the Governor of New South Wales, David Hurley, to one of the first events that we're holding in our new premises and the first G20 Study Centre event. I'm Leon Berkelmans. I am the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute, and I'm very lucky here today to be joined by David Dollar. David Dollar is a senior fellow at the John L. Thornton Center, China Center at the Brookings Institution. He is a long-time China scholar, first casting his eye there in the 1970s. He spent considerable time living in China. Notably, he was the country director for China and Mongolia for 5 years, and then following that, he was the US Treasury's representative in Beijing for 4 years. So, welcome, David. So I don't think I can recall a time where there's been so much conjecture about the state of a major economy in the world. We have the China bears saying that China's basically collapsing now, but we have the official data saying that China is growing at 7%. So I think everyone here would be very interested to hear your take on what's happening on China now and the major challenges they face.
Okay, thank you very much, Leon. It's really a great pleasure to be here at the Lowy Institute. For that first question, China's undergoing quite a difficult transition. I think the GDP data are basically right. They perhaps overstate growth a little bit in this kind of down cycle, and I think the data probably underestimate growth during the real boom times. But I myself feel that China's definitely growing faster than 6%, and that's both quite good in the international context, but it's also a very, very serious downshift from what China was doing a few years ago. And I think if we go a little bit deeper, you know, the main thing that's happening is that China's growth model has been very heavily dependent on investment for the last few years. You know, after the global crisis, they took investment up to 50% of GDP, which we've never seen in a big market economy before. That was good for stimulating the economy. It took GDP growth up above 11%. It benefited countries like Australia that export iron and a lot of developing countries that export other commodities. But the problem is it's unsustainable. It has led to very predictable excess capacity throughout the economy. So you've got empty apartments. You know, some estimates are that a fifth of apartments are empty. You've got excess capacity in manufacturing. And while they've built a lot of nice infrastructure, I think many of the recent extensions of highways and railways are basically low usage routes. So you know, they built a lot of infrastructure. Some of the recent projects have low returns. And so in this environment, naturally profits are slowing down in the face of this excess capacity, investment slowing down. You know, that's a good signal that this is basically a market economy. Not long ago, investment was growing at about 13% in real terms. Now that's slowed down to about 4% in real terms. The good news is consumption is holding up quite well, in some ways surprisingly well. Consumption's about half the economy. It's growing at 8%. It's been consistently growing at 8% for a long time. So in the boom period, it was declining as a share of GDP. Now it's rising slowly as a share of GDP because consumption's growing at about 8, and GDP is, as Leon said, slowed down to 6.9, I think, officially. I think maybe low sixes might be a more accurate estimate. So in some ways, the transition's going pretty well. Consumption is mostly services. So China's service sectors are growing well. So think of industry being in decline. Service sectors are growing well. Doesn't help Australian iron exporters. But Chinese people's lives are getting better. Services are more labor intensive, so they're creating jobs, income continues to go up. So I think in many ways the transition's going pretty well, but it's a big adjustment for the rest of the world. They're just not providing the same kind of demand that they were providing in the past.
So you spoke a little bit about Chinese data, the 6.9% officially reported. You think it's high sixes. That's sort of consistent actually with a lot of the old-timer sort of China scholars, I think, who cast a little bit more of a believing eye on the data. I'm thinking of people like Nick Lardy here. So you lived in China for a number of years. You worked at the World Bank. Was there anything that, why do you believe that the data is basically right? Were you involved with the statistical agencies in some way in helping to develop those data?
So China produces a lot of different data. Some of it, by the way, I think is pretty low quality. You know, their estimates of unemployment, you know, what they're actually trying to measure is not really clear, and that data is not particularly useful. But they produce a lot of different data. In the World Bank, we work closely with the National Bureau of Statistics on firm surveys and household surveys. I think their household surveys are very good. You know, they have a really excellent sampling frame. They go out in a systematic way. So I try to match the macro data with some of these other data sources. And what you're seeing in the household surveys is that household income continues to go up, you know, about 8% per year in real terms. Employment measured through that, you know, that vehicle seem, you know, is going up. So I think if you look at all the different data sources, I try to get a consistent picture. I don't believe the more negative views. I think the more negative views that China's really only growing at 1 or 2, they're focusing on the industry sector, which is slowed down, and they're missing this point that the service sectors, which are about half the economy, are actually growing quite well.
So you mentioned some of the challenges that, that the Chinese economy is facing. One of them is a big build-up in debt. So debt in China has been growing very quickly. I would like to refer back to a 2014 Article 4 consultation from the IMF. In that 2014 Article 4 consultation, the IMF said the following. Looking at a sample covering 43 countries over 50 years, staff identified only 4 episodes that experienced a similar scale of credit growth as China's recent total social financing growth. Within 3 years following the boom period, all 4 countries had a banking crisis. So you know, that doesn't sound good. And those words were written 18 months ago, at least 18 months ago. So according to that logic, we have less than 18 months to go before a banking crisis in China. Is that your expectation? And if not, why not?
Right, so the risks are definitely building up in the financial system. You know, I started by emphasizing what I think of as the real side, that they've overinvested, they've got too many empty apartments, excess capacity in manufacturing. But there's the financial side. A lot of that was backed by borrowing. You know, so of course, if you borrow and you make an investment that doesn't have a return, then you're going to have trouble paying off that loan. So we're definitely seeing non-performing loans rising in the banking system, risk building up. I don't think a financial crisis in the next 18 months is the most likely scenario. Okay, risks are building up, but I don't think it has, you know, above a 50% probability. China is different in a lot of ways. They're not relying on foreign financing. You've got state-owned banks lending to state-owned enterprises. That has lots of problems of inefficiency. But in this situation, they have the tools to clean up the financial system. It's mostly in-house, and I think China overall still has good fiscal situation. That doesn't mean they'll necessarily do it, but I think the most likely scenario is that they'll manage this. If we do have a banking crisis, it would be the result of some serious policy mistakes.
So you've got a fair degree of confidence then in the authorities, but has that confidence been shaken a little bit over the last year, 6 months or so? We've seen what I would characterise as several policy missteps with the currency, with securities markets. So does this give you some sort of pause for reflection here?
Yeah, so that's a great question. If we were having this discussion 8 months ago, I think I would have been more confident about China. The authorities have undermined some of the confidence with some really poor decision making. I think it was a mistake to let the bubble develop in the stock market, but then it was an even bigger mistake to intervene and try to prevent stock prices from correcting. I think ultimately they failed, so the stock market has gone down about 50%. It's hard to get really good data on corporate profits, but it seems that valuations are in a sensible range now, you know, unless corporate profits go down a lot more. So I think they made a mistake kind of using up their ammunition on the stock market, which is not very important. And then they're trying to delink their currency from the US dollar, but they've made a number of awkward moves and confused people with their communication. So I think they have undermined confidence, absolutely. So as I said, they have the tools to prevent a banking crisis, and I still wouldn't bet against them, but they have undermined confidence with their recent decision making.
So the authorities have come in for criticism for these missteps. And I viewed some of it, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with some of the criticism. I think a lot of it's been people rolling their eyes and wagging their finger at the Chinese saying, see, you guys just don't understand markets, what on earth are you doing? And I'm relatively uncomfortable with that for two reasons. First of all, it's not as if Western policymakers haven't messed up in the past. So going back all the way to when we, the US and Australia, were liberalising our markets, various missteps were made. And also thinking a little bit more recently, the GFC was there are some extraordinary policy mistakes there, especially during the crisis time. And secondly, it doesn't sit well with my my view of a number of Chinese technocrats. So in my former lives, I've had dealings with Chinese technocrats, and I've been very impressed with their quality. And I think you have a very similar opinion of them. So how do we view these missteps? How did these missteps happen? If the Chinese, well, we talked about how they have a number of policy levers, but also they're very good quality people there. So how should we think about these missteps?
Right. So I think it's a really good point. You know, obviously the U.S. has made some really serious missteps in recent years. You know, we've had two banking crises in the last few decades, and the most recent one had devastating effects on the world economy. You know, I have a lot of respect for the U.S. policymakers, the technocrats. So one way to think about this is that you put good technocrats in an institutional environment that has weaknesses, and we can get really bad results. You know, and I feel like what we learned in the global financial crisis is the U.S. has gone too far in the direction of deregulation. You know, and I don't want to go into detail about the U.S., but problems in the way we regulate the financial system so that you get regulatory arbitrage. So you put good people in bad institutions, you get bad results. That's a simple way of thinking about it. Like you, I have great respect for Chinese technocrats. You know, I think they have a lot of excellent technocrats. I worry that in their own way, they're getting into this problem of putting good people into weak institutional environments. For example, the head of China's central bank does not have the same kind of authority as the head of the Australian central bank or the head of the US central bank. You know, and so what we've seen in some of these recent decisions is a lot of confusion in the market. While it takes a few days, presumably decisions are being made at a very high political level. That level doesn't come out and communicate them, so you get a delay. Eventually, the technocrats are trying to communicate, but they may not actually agree with the compromise decision that was made at the top. So I do worry that some aspects of their institutional structure may not be well suited for fast-moving financial crises.
All right, and are we potentially looking at something right now where something's fast-moving and requires quick decisions in terms of the capital outflows and the loss of reserves that we heard about on the weekend?
Yeah, but it's actually kind of slow moving in some ways, you know. So there is, as they've tried to de-link from the U.S. dollar and create a certain amount of confusion, there's a lot of pressure now for the Chinese currency to depreciate in the market. It's a little bit strange. China had the largest trade surplus in human history last year, $600 billion. And I do think the long-run trend of the Chinese currency is going to be for further effective appreciation, because this is, you know, still an economy that has a lot of good fundamentals. But, you know, right now, I mean, an estimated net $1 trillion left China last year as capital outflow, and that seems to be continuing. The data we just got surprised a little bit in that they only spent about $90 billion of reserves in January. That's less than the market expected. But still, it's a pretty big number. Their reserve holdings are down to $3.2 trillion. You know, so they've gone down from over $4 trillion to $3.2 in a relatively short period of time. So they are facing this pressure. There's confusion about what they're doing. I think it's a good example of an important decision where we're not getting clear communication from them.
So the Chinese growth story hasn't really been, I think, from my perspective, one linear trend. People often think about the export juggernaut that we see right now, and they think that that's the way China has always developed. But from the start of the reform process, you had agricultural liberalisation, you had the agricultural sector growing quite quickly. Then following that, you had small-scale industrialisation. So I'm thinking here about the town and village enterprises that sort of marked that phase of development. And then I would argue that it was only really post-2000 that you saw this export juggernaut that was accompanied by very high levels of investment. So the is China going through another transition now? And how successful do you think they will be in making that transition?
Right. So that's a really nice way to conceptualize the long sweep of Chinese reform, because each of Leon's examples is a case where they took an important sector of the economy and they opened it up to private investment by Chinese people, international trade to a considerable extent, and in some cases, foreign investment. You know, so agriculture, and then the TVs and industry, and then a real private sector moving in industry. So I think from a policy point of view, one of the important challenges now is the service sectors are kind of the last frontier in China. They're relatively close to foreign trade and foreign investment. I emphasize that they're growing pretty well. They're the engine of growth. But these are sectors dominated by big state enterprises operating in an oligopolistic environment. So I think China would help itself a lot if it opened up those sectors. It would help its partners. You know, you used to export iron. Now you've got all these Chinese students and tourists here, which is great. But if you want to get into many of these other service markets, China would really have to open up investment in trade. And we haven't seen much bold move in that direction. I mean, to me, that's the obvious thing to do. Next frontier. We do not see much progress in the last couple of years.
If we saw that progress, would you fit into the camp that the Chinese economy can continue growing at, say, 8% for a number of years? So in that camp, Justin Lin and also Nick Lardy at the Peterson Institute, who say if they can pull off these reforms, China can keep growing at 8% for a very long time.
Yeah, I'm not sure Nick's quite at 8%, but I'm not sure optimistic is the right word, but I would have a lower kind of upper bound for them. And I think about this in a very simplistic way. You know, consumption, household plus government consumption is about 50% of the economy. It's been growing at 8% for a long time. To me, that's wonderful, and I can't see it really accelerating. So that delivers 4 percentage points of GDP growth. So anything beyond 4 is either coming from net exports, where I don't see China has a lot of potential to grow because it already has this enormous surplus, or it comes from investment. And I don't think it's in China's interest to have rapid growth of investment. I think growing around 4 and giving you 2 percentage points of growth, so to me, 6 is a nice target that makes rebalancing easier. And if you try to push that growth rate up closer to 8, you almost inevitably will be doing it through investment. And given all that excess capacity, it's just hard to see where all that investment's going to productively go.
And do you see that slowly ratcheting down as the decade? So by 2020, is it we still looking at 6%? Are we looking at 5 or 4?
You know, as you get out further in time, you know, that growth of consumption, the growth rate of consumption, as you get this famous hundreds of millions of people moving into the middle class, which is a true potential, but as that's completed over the next couple of decades, then the growth rate would naturally slow down quite a bit.
In 2003, you wrote a paper with the following words. It will be important to change the incentives for local government in order for these other structural reforms, to be thoroughly implemented. In my time in China, working for both the World Bank and the Treasury Department, I had extensive opportunities to travel around the country and meet with local government officials. The capacity of local government is really top-notch, but I came away with the impression that they did not get the memo. The talk about rebalancing has been going on for years, but local governments have remained fixated on investment and growth. Have we seen this change? So you wrote those words nearly 3 years ago?
Yeah, 2013.
Yes,
right.
That's right. Okay, right. So have things changed since then, or do you still hold those concerns?
Right. So I would say things have not changed too much, but they've changed a little bit. I had an opportunity to travel around China in December and meet with local governments. And again, it just struck me that a lot of them have not gotten the memo, right? So local government, you know, China has this big One Belt, One Road program, a lot of which is aimed at financing investment among partners, you know, among neighbors. But talking to local governments in the West, basically they see this as an opportunity to put a lot of projects into the planning agency for high-speed passenger rail, six-lane expressways, various other infrastructure development. So I see local government still, you know, very much in the mode of trying to pursue investment projects, some of which probably are fine and others of which are probably low return. Now, the little bit of good news is I do think you're starting to see a lot of popular pressure in China on certain issues, and the best one is air pollution. So most local governments are aware that their people are measuring, they're getting private measures of air pollution, PM 2.5, and they're worried about it, and they're putting pressure. You know, so I would say it's changing a little bit. You know, local governments are aware they have to meet a multiplicity of needs. They're looking at popular opinion surveys. It's interesting to have local officials say, well, you know, I saw the popular opinion survey and, you know, 85% of the people think cleaning up the air is the most important priority. So that's a healthy development, but I wouldn't exaggerate the importance because they're still very much, I think, measured on their ability to deliver investment and growth.
You mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative. This seems to be have captured some people's imagination of the way for Chinese to deal with their excess capacity problems and help develop the region. Do you hold high hopes for those aims?
Well, I think the One Belt, One Road, I think, is a perfectly fine initiative. One important aspect of that is the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. I've been an unpaid advisor to them and a supporter of AIIB, and I know Australia has joined, which I think is a sensible decision. So at this stage, you know, China is almost certainly going to run persistent current account surpluses. You know, I've emphasized consumption is growing pretty well, but I didn't see it really accelerating very much. It's slowly increasing its share of GDP, growing as it is, but it does seem like investment's ratcheting down. The current account is the difference between your savings rate and your investment rate. I think there'll be a significant current account surplus, maybe pressure for it to grow. China's going to be a big financer of the rest of the world. To direct some of that to your neighbors, improving infrastructure, that's fine. I tell Chinese friends, it's not smart to go around saying this is a way to deal with your surplus. It's not likely to work that way. You know, the excess capacity in steel, for example, is just enormous. China's not going to be able to export that. And as it finances projects in nearby countries, a lot of those countries are not going to want Chinese construction workers or Chinese construction companies. You know, finance is finance. It's not necessarily going to alleviate the Chinese surplus. So I don't think it's realistic, and it's not really smart diplomatically, you know, to tell your neighbors that you have this nice initiative and then have your own, you know, discourse on the internet saying this is really important for exporting China's surplus.
So the initiatives as far as the AIIB go and the BRICS Bank, these are new initiatives for China to try and take a bit of a lead in the world of economic governance. There's a lot of discussion, which I find a little bit tedious and boring, about is this a challenge to the World Bank and the IMF? Because I don't think that they are challenges. But the question I'm more interested in is, will these institutions be successful? And what would success look like for these institutions? Could you say a few words about that?
Right, so I agree with you that I don't see it as a challenge to the existing international order. You know, we have quite a few multilateral development banks. We seem to welcome a system where there's some competition among multilateral banks. You know, the world has called upon China to be more of a responsible stakeholder. So I would think this would be a nice example of China putting up money to support the development of infrastructure in developing countries. So success some years down the road, this bank will be funding the same volume of projects as the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank. If it could actually do it a little bit more quickly, be a little bit less risk averse, I would welcome that. I think it's already having a positive effect on the World Bank and the ADB. And you know, that's one of the success indicators would be it's generating a healthy kind of competition.
And also in the world of economic governance, China is the president of the G20 at the moment. And in the realm of the G20, we hear a lot of discussion about inclusive growth. And one of the papers that you wrote many years ago, it was a paper I read in grad school and was one of my favourite papers I read in grad school. It was called Growth is Good for the Poor. And what it basically did, what it showed that the major thing that reduced poverty was growth, right? You can adopt all sorts of different policies, but really the major thing lifting people out of poverty is growth. You wrote a follow-up piece in 2013 with an expanded data set showing essentially the same thing, and really getting into this question of what policies can be pro-poor. And I think the conclusion from that was that really there aren't that many policies that you can identify as being particularly pro-poor. It's just growth is the most important thing. So in this context, it really does look to me like all of this discussion about inclusive growth, making sure we have policies to bring the poor up, might be a little bit wasted. Isn't growth just inclusive growth?
Right. So I guess I would nuance the results a little bit differently. So, you know, we can't find generic policies that shift the income distribution in favor of the poor. It would be remarkable, you know, if there were such things. But I do think in each individual country, you know, there may very well be policies that are good for distribution and also good for growth. So in my own country, I favor distributional policies. For example, you know, we haven't invested enough in early childhood education, and lots of evidence that this benefits the poor. Hard to prove, but my intuition is that this is good for growth. And in fact, and it's that statistically, it's that growth impact that in the long run is really going to have the main effect. I mean, it's really a very simple result. Over long periods of time, per capita income goes up many fold, but the income share of any particular group does not go up many fold. It's impossible, right? I mean, those are shares. So without getting too technical, you know, I try to look for policies unique to a particular country that would be, you know, good for growth and may very well have a beneficial effect on income distribution. Like I think in China, reforming the household registration system is likely to be good for growth and good for distribution. So I think you probably have country-specific policies. But my co-authors and I were trying to get people away from thinking that there was somehow a simple recipe for bringing about growth that would also shift this income distribution in favor of the poor.
Am I right in thinking about this as a bit like a Danny Roderick point, that you need to make sure you understand the context of the country? You can't come in with some sort of blank slate and say, oh, you must do this, 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 and this. It needs to be a little bit more contextual.
Yeah.
Another paper you wrote a number of years ago, a very popular one of yours, was a piece about foreign aid in 2000. And what you said was aid was basically good if good policies existed on the ground of the recipient country. If bad policies existed, aid actually had little to no effect. This seems to be a bit of a middle way between the great aid debate. So we, on one side, we have Bill Easterly and I guess Angus Deaton now, who says that aid potentially actually could be damaging. Angus Deaton mentioned this in his book, that aid could be a way that entrenches bad governments. And then on the other side, on the optimistic side, you have Jeff Sachs saying that all we need to do is give them much more aid, and that will end poverty. So we probably don't have time to sort out that debate here. But one thing you did say in that article was that policies seem to be getting better in the developing world. That being the case, if policies have, and that was written in 2000, if policies have been getting better over the last 15 years, has aid indeed become more effective since you wrote that paper?
Right, so it's hard to prove, but that's certainly my experience, my intuition. I think we've gone through a golden age of developing country growth, you know, starting about 15 to 20 years ago. And we've seen, you know, better, certainly a lot of more trade openness among developing countries, better macroeconomic management. You don't run into high inflation very much anymore in today's world. So a lot of things that were symptomatic of developing countries in the 1970s, 1980s, we really don't see much of that anymore. And we've had a golden age of growth. I think effective development assistance has contributed to that, but I would give it an assist. I would put most of the emphasis on the direct impact of good institutions and policies. But I do think in that environment, foreign aid can accelerate growth. And I think there are plenty of good historical examples of this.
What would be one of those?
Well, my favorite one is the Marshall Plan. You know, I'm a big fan of the Marshall Plan. And so the notion that, yeah, sure, Europe would have recovered without that financial assistance. It fundamentally had good market-oriented institutions, but I think that assistance accelerated it, locked in success, locked in a long period of prosperity. So maybe it would have been okay without it, but why would you take that risk?
Last year, Lance Pritchett wrote a piece. Have you ever co-authored with
Matt? Oh, yeah. Lant and I are old friends, yeah.
So he wrote a piece on development and aid agencies. So I think he had very much had in mind the World Bank, talking about how aid agencies very much had, that were funded by Western governments, had what he called post-materialistic values. So that these guys really cared a lot about, say, civil society and possibly the environment, whereas the recipient countries, all they wanted was actually to get rich. What they wanted to was to reduce poverty. And this stuff about civil society and the environment, they weren't as concerned about. And he was suggesting that this was a big problem in the world of the World Bank and other aid agencies. What's your take on that?
Right. So Lant and I wrote a report together called Assessing Aid, which pulled together a lot of that aid effectiveness research about 20 years ago. On this one, I think the problem Lant's identifying, I would call a small problem. You know, and I think it makes sense that rich countries that fund, you know, the concessional assistance and poor countries would have different preferences. And Lant's example's perfectly sensible. Rich country electorates might value environmental issues more. Poor country electorates, people value poverty reduction more. You know, it makes sense. The way I think about it is, in most developing countries that are getting significant amount of aid, say the government wants to do 10 things, and the donors particularly like three of them. The donors are going to come in and focus on those three, but one of the things we put, you know, front and center in our report is money's fungible. So any well-managed government has some resources of its own, right? So I think in most cases, developing countries, I would say this fits into my example of, or my argument, developing countries drive the agenda. You know, so donors focus on the two or three things that are popular. Developing country does the full range, and that's the ultimate impact is really based on that full range. And the exception would be a few aid junkies. You know, if you're really getting sort of 80 or 90% of your budget from donors, then the argument I just made doesn't hold up. But it's really hard to see how that qualifies as any kind of decent management, because even the poorest countries should be able to get some tax collection and have some capacity on their own.
Do you view the AIIB and the BRICS Bank as having different values as the existing multilateral institutions?
Well, AIB, which I know better, I mean, that is a big multilateral bank that will have a majority of developing country shareholders in terms of shares. So it'll be interesting to see if they make some different choices. You know, for example, I don't know if it's a prohibition, but it seems like the existing banks have gotten out of the business of financing coal-fired power plants, for example. That's a nice example where if you're a very poor country like India and you have a lot of coal, you know, you might want to go ahead and have coal-fired power plants, you know, given that there are enormous numbers of them in the United States and Europe, for example. But if you're the, you know, a development agency based in some northern environment, you may not want to be known as someone financing coal-fired power plants. So it'll be very interesting to see some, you know, concrete results over the next few years.
Okay, well, we'll open it up to questions in a moment, but first of all, we'll do something, something I think that's a little bit of fun. I'm ripping this off completely from Tyler Cowen's podcasts, if any of the audience happen to listen to those. He plays this game with his interviewees called Overrated, Underrated, or Fairly Valued. I'm going to throw out various things to you, and you have to tell me whether these things are overrated, underrated, or fairly valued, and give a very short explanation for why you think that's the case. So, to start off with, Xi Jinping.
We haven't seen a lot of economic reform yet, so I think I have to wait to the end of the year. I guess I would say fairly valued for the moment, but this year is going to tell us a lot about his decision making.
Okay. The World Bank.
Yeah. So as someone who worked there for a long time, I view this as self-criticism. I think we could do a better job, you know. So I think we're overrated. We could be more focused and more risk, you know, more risk-taking.
You were the country director for Mongolia as well as China. So Mongolia.
Mongolia is underrated. You know, what an amazing success story. 70 years of communism, and they've made a very smooth transition to a well-functioning, you know, civil society and democracy where parties alternate. So I'm a big fan of Mongolia.
Okay. The Chinese Communist Party.
That one's tough. We have to be honest, the first 30 years of rule, they didn't really make people's lives in China much better on average. And then they switched direction, and there's been a tremendous progress in more recent decades. So I guess I would say history's still out on this one.
Yeah. Deng Xiaoping.
Deng Xiaoping relates to the last one in the sense that, you know, he certainly played an important role in that switching models, switching directions around 1978, 79. So Chinese people have huge respect for him. He made certain decisions that kind of prevented political liberalization from accompanying economic reform. I know a lot of Chinese people, you know, support that decision, but I think you can't really develop without becoming more politically open. And so we need to see, you know, is this going to end up with a happy ending in the next few decades?
And finally, we're a little bit self-obsessed in Australia, so I'm going to ask you Australia.
Oh, I'm a big fan of Australia, so really, really happy to be here. But seriously, I think you play a very useful role. I've gotten to see the U.S.-China dialogue up close. It's got lots of positives, but it's just inherently tense. It's just really hard for the U.S. and China to be good friends in any sense. So I think Australia plays a very important role. You've got a deep integration with China, but you're not fawning. You're supporting, for example, the U.S. Freedom of Navigation operations. And I think you've found a really nice middle ground that plays an important role in the world.
Thank you very much. So I would like to open it up to questions now. There's a couple of mics around the place, so just raise your hand right here in the front row to start with.
Hello, sir. Very good. I'm Rob McDougall. I'm the Canadian Consul General for the time being. I spent 4 years in China in the late 70s, early 80s, so I saw the beginning of the successive waves. So much has changed since then. Every time I go back, I have no idea where I am anymore. But there is one thing that seems to not to have changed, and that's the strong role of state-owned enterprises. So a question to you. What can be done about them and what should be done about them from the Chinese perspective?
Right. So first I would say, statistically, their role in the economy has diminished somewhat over time. The Chinese manufacturing sector is largely private, and I recently saw an interesting study. You probably hear that most of China's exports come from foreign firms, which is sort of true in a shallow sense, but the value added in China's exports mostly comes from the Chinese private sector, which I think is quite interesting, not from state enterprises and not from foreign invested firms. So manufacturing, I think there's been a lot of progress, but there are exceptions, a lot of steel mills in China, the big auto companies are these awkward joint ventures between foreigners and, you know, the city of Beijing or the city of Shanghai. So, and then I emphasize services, I think, is a real problem. You know, you've got in banking and other financial services, airlines, media, a lot of the modern service sectors dominated by state enterprises. To me, that would be the obvious next frontier. You know, open up to foreign competition, which would put pressure on them. Many of them are listed, so you could have a model of moving toward majority private ownership. So I don't see that kind of visionary, you know, focus on the next phase.
Is it going to happen?
It's going to happen. It's just I've often had senior Chinese people say to me, you know, we basically agree on policy, and you just want to see it in 2 or 3 years, and we plan to do it over 100 years. You Americans are so impatient, you know. So.
Robert Milliner, you made a number of comments, particularly from an economic perspective, but if you look at China as a whole, both in terms of what it's done in terms of the economy, but also what it's doing geopolitically, particularly around the South China Sea, could you just make some observations about whether, given its place in history and the economic and political development of other countries comparatively, we put too much emphasis on China or hold it to too high a standard compared to the development of other Western countries over time and the mistakes they've made. So earlier in your comments, for example, talking about regulatory decisions over the last 8 months, you made the comment about mistakes. But on the other hand, they've responded to those actually very quickly and appear to have learned from the mistakes, say intervention in the security markets fairly quickly. So do we, given second largest economy in the world, put it into a place that other Western countries haven't been put in at their time in history and development? Thank you.
Right, so very good question, thank you. It's not my area of expertise, but I genuinely think China is making a mistake with its activism in the South China Sea. I have Chinese friends who say to me, you know, this is very similar to the Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century. And my response is, that was a mistake by the United States in the 19th century, and we heard it from our neighbors pretty quickly, and the United States would never, you know, go to Latin America and, you know, tell Latin American countries, don't welcome Chinese investment, for example. You know, I think Chinese investment in Brazil, other countries in Latin America, that's fine. So I just think it's a little bit old-fashioned for China to think it can carve out this sort of special zone and everyone has to, in the region, has to kowtow to China because it's the biggest economy and it'll be the biggest military power. But I don't think it's likely to come to real, you know, shooting war, but I think it's a mistake on China's part because it's alienating its neighbors. You know, it's driven some of them towards a closer strategic alliance with the United States. I'd much rather see peace in the Pacific. You know, we all benefit enormously from freedom of navigation and from having a peaceful environment. So, you know, I think they're making a mistake, but I don't view it as too big a mistake.
David Wildman, thank you very much. Is the alleviation of the changes to the China One Child policy perhaps more of a consumption lever rather than reaction to a social demand?
Yeah, so I think that was a very good decision, a little bit late in coming, you know, could have come years earlier, but I actually think that was a good decision, you know, as I understand it, made by Xi Jinping at the very top with some opposition from parts of the bureaucracy. I think you all know raising children is a consumption good, basically. In the long run, this will have a small effect on China's demographics, it'll have a small effect on the labor force, but that's more than 20 years out. So the main effect it'll have in the short run is encourage more consumption, and I think that's helpful in this environment. And the main important thing is just moving toward more human freedom. You know, so forget about economics. It's good that people are able to have more children if they want to have more children. Why didn't they just get rid of the limit? You know, so sometimes it's hard to understand decisions. But I guess the bureaucracy that was counting your one child, now that bureaucracy is going to count your two children. So there's still a role for an enormous fertility police, and maybe that's the reason for not just saying, you know, let's get rid of limits. But it's a good, really good step in the right direction.
Debt levels have been rising quite sharply. Local government debt, SOE debt, even individual institutions, universities across China building huge new campuses and taking on unsustainable levels of debt. Sometimes that's been associated with corruption. How good a grip do you think we really have on levels of debt in China, and how big an impact do you think that's having on the economy going forward?
Right. So, I think this kind of data is basically pretty good in China. I mean, a slightly cynical way to think about it is if they're making up that data, then they're making up alarming data. Okay. So, you know, so maybe the truth is even more alarming. But I just don't buy into the conspiracy theories. I think certain data have errors, but I think those data are pretty good. And, you know, they have built up this enormously leveraged economy. Chinese people have high savings, as we know. They put their money in their banks. One reason that I don't put too high a probability on the banking crisis scenario is it would almost require Chinese people to lose confidence in the state-owned banks and pull their money out, because that's the ultimate financing source. And I don't see Chinese people losing confidence in the state-owned banks, which officially have a deposit insurance scheme. But it is worrisome. They need to get, you know, they need to move on it. They talk about it, you know, but they need to let some firms go bankrupt. They need to let some bonds default, which will be a little bit scary. In their policy mix, that's why I'm don't favor much monetary stimulus in their policy mix, because they've already got this very high degree of leverage. I think they could do more with fiscal stimulus, things that are aimed at sponsoring consumption, and, you know, start making progress cleaning up some of that mess in the financial system.
Including the shadow banking sector.
That's part of it. You know, they go through phases where they got worried about official credit, you know, for corporations. So they encouraged the development of the shadow banking system. More recently, they encouraged the development of P2P. And then I'm sure you've all read, they've got this enormous Ponzi scheme, $7.6 billion Ponzi scheme. So there are plenty of things to worry about in the financial system. As I said, I didn't think crisis was the most likely scenario in the next 18 months, because they do have a lot of tools to deal with it.
Hi, Daniel Bean from ANZ. Two questions, if I can. I guess the first one is in terms of the progress that's being made and policymakers' views on that. Do you think that broadly they're happy with the speed of transition, with the volatility that the transition's brought in markets and within the economy, and whether or not, I guess we're in for a bit more of the same as this transition continues, or whether or not we can expect some slowdown in that? And then the other question, which just hasn't been addressed today, is I'm interested in your views on the corruption campaigns and the sustainability of those and the impact that those are having on growth and can continue to.
Okay, so I think the technocrats agree with the point I made earlier, that it's easier to rebalance at a growth rate of about 6. So I think they have intense internal arguments. You know, the political leaders, you know, they've actually said out loud 6.5 is the minimum they need to hit their 2020 target, I guess. Yeah, 2020 target. I think it's easier to rebalance at 6. But yeah, they're starting to say things like around 6.5 or, you know, or at least 6. And so, you know, there's some obviously discussion between the technocrats and the people at the top. The second question was about the
corruption.
A couple of thoughts on the corruption campaign. So it's fine, you know, it's fine to go after corruption. I don't see that what they're doing mostly, I see it not really as systemic. You know, to me, systemic would be requiring all your officials and their families to declare assets and income. Actually, freedom of the press is probably the best systemic thing you can do to control corruption. So I don't see it as systemic. I don't see it as narrowly focused on one so-called faction, you know, within their party. There seem to be people from different political groupings who've been caught up in this. So it does strike me as a little bit ad hoc, but it's having the effect of making everybody nervous and probably making everybody a little bit less corrupt, which could be a good thing. Some people worry that this somehow will have bad macroeconomic effects. I'm skeptical about that. I don't think the consumption of those corrupt officials is, you know, is that big a share of GDP. As I said, consumption's been growing fine throughout this campaign, so I don't see any evidence that it's hurting things. Some people worry that, you know, local government officials are less likely to carry out investment projects. But I told you, when I met a bunch of officials in December, they seemed perfectly thrilled to carry out investment projects if they could get the go-ahead and get the funding. So I don't really see it having that big of an effect.
Over in the back.
Carol Austin. If you look at the industrial sector in China, there is deflation widespread across the industrial sector. It's obvious in steel and in glass and cement, but it goes more deeply than that into the manufacturing sector. Deflation is evident across the whole of Asia. So the normal policy response to that would be to cut interest rates, to stimulate demand, to depreciate your currency, to try and get some inflation going. They're the policies that Japan's using and is applauded by markets. When China attempts to use these policies, they're castigated by markets. So it does appear to be two sets of rules, one for Japan and one for China. Do you think there's a logic to that? And what should China do to address the deflation in the industrial sector?
Right. So I think China made a mistake by not introducing more flexibility in their currency earlier. You know, when they had large current account surpluses and inflows of capital, you know, they resisted the appreciation. They allowed a very large current account surplus to develop in a boom time, which I personally think is a mistake. So they are somewhat different from Japan. Remember, Japan had current account deficit quite recently, and it certainly doesn't have a big current account surplus. So I think, and Japan actually has overall deflation in its economy. So Japan, I think, has a pretty good case for its monetary policy. China's complicated things because it's got this enormous trade and current account surplus. And as you say, it has deflation in tradables, but it's got perfectly healthy inflation in the service sectors. And overall, you know, it's got overall CPI inflation similar to the United States. So I lack sympathy for them pursuing, well, I actually just don't think it's in their interest to pursue aggressive monetary easing. You know, it relates back to the leverage question. You know, it's kind of, it's just kind of continuing, you know, that binge in the industrial sector. Depreciation makes your people poorer, so it's actually going to cut into that transition towards more consumption-led growth. So to me, the courageous thing would be more fiscal stimulus aimed at consumption, moving ahead with structural policies, and keeping monetary policy. They say they're following prudent monetary policy, so sort of sticking to that. I don't think a big devaluation is going to help them, you know, partly because of where they need to go in terms of this transformation, but also, you know, for a big economy like China, which has not had a flexible exchange rate, if they suddenly say they're not going to intervene, then I think the market could take their exchange rate quite, you know, quite far in terms of depreciation. And that could be unruly enough in the world market that they don't really get any benefit. You know, if it sets off a wave of emerging market financial crises, they're not likely to get a lot of benefit from it.
Hello, I'm Sophia Chen, a junior solicitor at Addisons, and I've got a question in relation to the CHAFTA. I'd be very interested and curious to hear your thoughts about perhaps some of the challenges for both countries in relation to the agreement, and despite, for example, a lot of the opportunities, and of course in relation to e-commerce and whatnot, I'd be very curious to hear about some of the challenges.
So this is about China-Australia free trade.
Very well done. Okay. Excellent. Yes.
So, right. So I'm not an expert on this, but I'm pretty sure, you know, all of the advanced economies, Australia, the United States, you know, European partners, we're all trying to encourage China to open up more in different sectors. China is very partially open, quite open in some areas, but really very closed in others. So I'm pretty sure Australia did not get kind of a magic breakthrough in all the key service sectors. If you did, then bully for you.
I think it depends who you talk to. If you talk to DFAT, they'll say it was wonderful.
It may very well be very good for Australia, but I am skeptical that China has opened up a lot of sectors to Australia while not opening up to Canada, for example, and other partners. So I think we all face this challenge, you know, that it would be in China's interest to open up more. It is the most closed of the G20 countries in terms of foreign investment. You know, and that's a group that includes Indonesia and India, plenty of countries that are not, you know, that are relatively poor developing countries. So as I said, I'm not an expert on your agreement. You know, if it's getting Australia better access in the Chinese markets, then I think that's a step in the right direction. But U.S. is negotiating a bilateral agreement with China as well, investment. These things should not be substitutes, you know, for creating a much bigger open market. You know, ultimately, for example, if China could join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if we could get that implemented, you know, that would be very substantial progress.
There's been a gentleman who's been very patient there up the back.
Hi there. My name is Andrew Morton. I study at the School of Government at Peking University. I was just interested to hear your assessment on Xi Jinping as having supreme leader status and how the current distribution of power in Chinese government is affecting policy decisions in the country.
Right. So I have colleagues at Brookings who specialize in this, and they know more about this than I do. What I hear from them, that there is this sense that Xi Jinping is the most powerful leader, you know, in a long time. But then when I just focus on what's actually being accomplished in terms of economic reform, I'm not impressed. And, you know, early in this particular five-year cycle, they put out a third plenum resolution that was a pretty good blueprint of economic reform. And in my view, they're moving rather slowly on it. You know, so maybe Xi Jinping's really powerful and his preference is just to move very, very slowly. You know, I think many of us were hopeful that he was more reform-minded, and that suggests perhaps he's not so powerful, that he's got to deal with a lot of different interest groups. He's got to bring different groups along. Reform is difficult. And I just focus on the end result. It seems to be going slowly.
One up the back there.
Yuri Vint. The China's had a going out policy in terms of foreign investment, and we've seen it in Australia in terms of resource security and food security investments, and recently in property. Is that policy likely to continue, and more aggressively or less aggressively?
Right, so I think it'll accelerate. So this Chinese policy of going out has been going on for a while. And initially, 10 years ago, a lot of it was focused on Chinese, you know, extractive firms going out and looking for new supply of metals and energy. I think that's diminishing. You know, China does not have as much appetite, and obviously a lot of those prices have gone down. Some of China's deals have been very, very bad. So I think a number of factors are muting that trend. On the other hand, as I said, they're going to have a large current account surplus for a long time. So they will probably emerge as the largest net creditor in the world, surpassing Japan. And I think a lot of that is just going into diversified investments. We're getting enormous amount of that in the United States. I mentioned China, you know, has this program to encourage investment in its neighbors, you know, which is fine. But I do think the vast majority of the money is going to places like the United States and Australia. It's going into diversified sectors, and it's going into real estate among that. And the only problem I see with it is this asymmetry. You know, that China remains very closed to direct investment in many sectors. For example, China State Enterprise bought our biggest pork producer in the United States. It would be much more economically sensible for our world-class pork producer to buy a Chinese firm and get into the Chinese market, but that's just not allowed. So the best thing for the American shareholders was just let the Chinese company take you over so that then you can get partially into the Chinese market in that sort of second best way. So I think that's an important issue for Australia and the U.S. You know, is there a problem in this kind of uneven competition?
Just on the policy sense, given what your comments about the China Free Trade Arrangement Agreement and Australia's economic constructs, the way we've been faring recently, what policy advice would you give the Australian government replanning our future economic relationship with China over the next decade or so?
Right. So I'm sincerely admirer. You know, so I think, you know, trying to negotiate even more openness, getting China to open up its service sectors. You know, I think mining is just not going to play the same role in the world that it has in this recent past. And so you have a lot of other sectors that can get into that. As an American, I'm very happy that Australia is getting this deeper economic integration with China, you know, but you continue to stand with the United States on issues like freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. I think that's the smart strategy. You know, I think that's the right thing to do.
All right, so that's basically time. I'm going to ask one very quick question to finish off. So number of risks are building in the Chinese economy, but you've been looking at the Chinese economy for decades. Is the Chinese economy riskier now than at any time during your study?
It's not riskier than at any time during the study, but it's so much more important now. You know, if you remember back to 1989, you know, even before Tiananmen, there was high inflation, a lot of problems, state enterprises closing. You know, I think there are times when the economic risks were greater, but China's so important in the world economy now that, you know, this is a somewhat unique moment of big risk in China and China having an outsized influence on the world. So I think it's the big story in economics for 2016. You know, can China navigate this rather difficult passage? And we have to wish them well, because if they don't do well, it's certainly going to have a spillover effect on Australia, Canada, United States, all of us.
Well, thank you very much, David. Thank you all for coming. Please come again soon. We have one event that next week that may be of interest to you. I'm in conversation with Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson next week, talking about the US economy, Betsy's time in the White House, Justin's work with the New York Times. So it should be a great discussion. So in any case, hope to see you here again soon.